Good morning, everyone. Right, I think I know what the problem is. How many here are morning people? All right, normally I would hate you, but as a sysadmin, I actually like you because you get to do the early shifts. But at the moment, those of you who put up your hands, I'm not a morning person and I don't drink coffee, so you're not allowed to ask questions because my brain hasn't switched on yet. Welcome to September. Welcome to Administrator's Idol. Did anybody actually come along to this talk last year? Okay, there are a couple of hands. If you're expecting anything different, it isn't. So if you want to go along to another session, that's cool. But for those of you who did stick up your hands, thank you very much for the evaluations and the comments from last year. I have taken those comments on board and have hopefully fixed up a few issues that happened last year. One of those issues was outside of my control, and that was getting a bigger room. So for those of you who came along last year, thank you. My name's Pete Calvert. I've been working with Windows systems, supporting them for over 20 years now. I don't do that anymore. I let other people actually do the hard work of looking after it. So a big shout out to all the sysadmins here. You do a great job. Very unappreciated. Hope you had a good sysadmin day last month. Or was it the month before? I do a lot of training and consulting now, particularly in the Active Directory space. So the goal for today, this is actually a mashup session. It actually combines material from two sessions that were presented in TechEd North America last year. One of those sessions was by Rick Claus, who's presenting after here in the next session. He's actually out here for the first time, and we got him to eat Vegemite yesterday. That's up on YouTube. We did give him some Tim Tams, Lamingtons, and ginger beer as well, so he's okay with that. It was on migrating from Server 2003 to 2008, so his talk after this session is also going to be on migrating servers. The other session that I've pulled material from, we've sort of cherry-picked the best bits, is from Dan Holmes' Administrator Idol talk, and that has a wealth of information in it. I do have a link to his website at the end in the slide deck here. And if you want to grab any of the bits and pieces that he talks about in his session, he's here as well. He's also spending a fair bit of time at the AvPoint stand in the Expo Hall. If you want to drill any questions on him, feel free, and he is planning on having an updated version with PowerShell next year. The other lesson I've learnt presenting at TechEd is to try and appease the demo gods, and if you can't do that, and I seem to fail miserably at that, is to have a backup plan. So I'm actually using Camtasia videos of all the demos. That way you won't have to sit through and watch progress bars. And it also means that you won't see demos fail. Now, Camtasia is produced by TechSmith. Betsy Weber, who is a TechSmith evangelist, is also out here for the first time. And because she is, I got her to eat Vegemite yesterday as well. So we're going to cover some of the key benefits that 2008 R2 brings to administration. That's going to be the first half of the talk. Many of these areas you will have already seen. There might be one or two that you haven't. Hopefully there'll be one or two at least that you haven't. We're not going to cover the big sexy things like ADFS, group policy preferences, universal single sign-on and PowerShell 2. We don't have time to devote anything to that. But we will cover some other things. The second half of the talk, we're going to have a look at some things that aren't restricted to 2008 R2. So those of you who are operating in older environments will be able to take advantage of that. But let's kick off. Active Directory is now 11 years old. I'll ask a question. Where were you 11 years ago? Did your server room look like this? Does it still look like this? If you remember, we moved from Windows NT4 to Windows 2000, Active Directory. Previously, we had NT4 domains with users and resources up to a maximum of 40,000 accounts. If we outgrew the domain, we'd need to have multiple domains, which we could have users and resources in each one, and we would set up trusts between them. Is this familiar to anybody here? Okay, so about a quarter of the room have stuck up their hands. The rest of you, thank God that you didn't go through the pain. When we wanted to centralize account management, we set up a separate domain for users and then had resource domains so we could delegate administration of resources so that those people didn't have access to the user accounts. And then we had to remember, how the heck do we do the trusts? Which way do the arrows point? And we extended and expanded. And normally by the time we made the shift to Windows 2000, many of our networks sort of looked a bit like this. So Active Directory came on the scene 11 years ago and said, we will be able to fix that for you. You won't have to worry about setting up trusts between different domains. We can have a forest. We can have an area where you can delegate administration by using organizational units. We've even got a wizard that lets you do it. This was great 11 years ago. When was the last time you actually revisited your AD design? Many places that I've talked to really haven't touched anything since then. So let's take a step back and have a look at, well, we've got an Active Directory design that's in place, and for some of you, you might have actually done some work recently looking at the design. But for many places, many people, if you didn't design it yourself, you might have had a consultant come in. You weren't involved with the project, you might have inherited it after it was done. Or you've just moved into the role and have got absolutely no idea what design processes were involved. A poll last year on what sort of operating systems people were running in their organizations was done in TechEd North America. And as you can see from the pie chart, a bit under half had moved to 2008 and 2008 R2. So more than 50% were still living in a 2003 or earlier world. How many here have moved to 2008 or 2008 R2? Can we have a show of hands, please? Okay, so for those of you who have, that's about a third of the room. Fantastic. For those of you who haven't, hopefully some of the things that we're going to cover today will give you ammunition to convince management to spend money to go through the process of redesigning your network and migrating to 2008 R2 especially. The challenges that we faced, and you probably still face this in many regards, is that we have multiple skill levels of admin. Now, this week is a technical education week. You are here to learn. Hopefully, you're here to be entertained as well, but primarily, you're probably being given the ticket here to learn. That means that you have a responsibility to your organizations. You are the rocket scientists. You are going to go back with the knowledge and then let the other people know what they need to do or what they don't need to do. We have other issues that we need to consider. Security at remote offices. Quite a few years ago, Customs in Australia had outsourced their IT management to EDS and seemed to be doing fine. A couple of guys dressed in suits wandered into the office in Sydney and said, we're here to check out the servers, and they certainly did. They picked up some domain controllers and walked out with them. We can help mitigate problems around those sort of things happen, and they weren't from EDS, by the way, if you were questioning that. We can mitigate a certain degree of these security issues if we move to 2008 R2. We have the problems of deploying new workstations, and there are a stack of sessions around managing Windows 7 and deployment tools, but how do you get a machine on the domain if it can't be connected to the domain. We'll touch on that today. We'll look at managing accounts, specifically managing service accounts, which I know sysadmins love to do. And we'll look at password policies. Now, the general rule of thumb, especially for those of you who have been operating or operating in 2003 and earlier, is if you want to have different password policies, you need to have different domains. We can fix that. And that's a good thing. There was a poll done quite a while ago at the CEO, CIO level on popular passwords. And do you know what the most popular password was for CEOs? Golf. Auditing resources is also something that is a pain in the neck to do. And during the second half, we'll have a little look at some of the things that we can use, some of the tricks that we can use to assist us in getting information out of the system, bless you, without actually having to do extra work. So for those of you still on 2003, this is really a good opportunity in looking to migrate to 2008 R2 to revisit your design. Those of you who have already moved, it may give you an idea to go back and just check things out and perhaps tweak things a little in order to improve it. Do we go to virtual machines? If you have virtual domain controllers, I would suggest you might want to come along to my session this afternoon to have a look at the impact of cloning and virtualization on AD domain services. Do we use read-only domain controllers to fix up security at the branches and some of the issues around that? We won't dig into RODCs in any depth here, but if you've got questions about those, I'm more than happy to answer them. Server core. Has anybody actually deployed server core? The brave 10% in the room. If you've deployed server core using 2008, I'm sorry. If you have deployed server 2008 core R2, that's a lot better. Those of you who haven't because you've been scared, I'll actually go through and show you how easy it is to get remote management to a 2008 R2 machine. So, let's have a look at that. It's a little tool called sconfig that the server team pinched from the Hyper-V team. Essentially, in order to manage a server core box, we follow the numbers. We don't have to worry about all the OC setup commands, going in and changing firewall settings manually, configuring network settings. And I'm just expanding the back-end commands that are running here. Normally this is minimized. All running PowerShell, and we've enabled PowerShell. It's running in the back-end. We've got a lovely little command here. So this was a fresh install of 2008 R2 core. And we now drop back to the management interface, which is just a command line, and that's it. That is all that is actually required in order to get the 2008 R2 core box remotely managed. These videos are actually included in the PowerPoint deck, so if after the session you want to download the PowerPoint decks, it's about 32 meg. I've tried to compress things as much as possible while still keeping resolution, so you can actually view all the demos without having to listen to me rabbit on. Another feature that R2 brings is the Active Directory Recycle Bin. had a situation a few years ago where I was at another event, had a phone call. We have got a client who has had an oops moment. They went to delete a user, and they deleted the OU that user was in. Can we fix it? And I said, sure, we can fix it. We just need to do an authoritative restore. I can hear some giggles. Those people have obviously done an authoritative restore before. Yes, we could do that. They decided that it was actually better to start recreating the user accounts, and 3 days later they were 75% of the way through that. I couldn't help them after that. But this days, with R2, we can actually do things a heck of a lot better. That would be the wrong button. Previously, it used to be the case that if you deleted a user, the wrong user, it would often initiate what we like to call in the industry a resume generating event. Now, however, with the recycle bin in place, and you have to enable it, and we will go through that. If you have a user and the recycle bin enabled, and you delete the user, it's just a very simple matter of pulling them back out. In fact, the user might not even be aware that they've sometimes been left in limbo. For those of you who want to live vicariously and delete managers' accounts from time to time and then pull them back from the recycle bin, I'm not suggesting you do that, but if you decide to do that, put the recycle bin in place first. It does make some schema changes. It is a one-way process. You cannot undo the recycle bin. But if you don't have that ability to do that, and there's a fair number of you who are running older systems, 2003 and perhaps earlier, in Active Directory, if you turn on the advanced view, there is a checkbox that you can use that says protect from accidental deletion. All that does is when you click to delete the item, it says, sorry, we're stopping you from deleting this. To delete it, you need to go and uncheck the box, and then you can delete it. So if you haven't had your third cup of coffee in the morning, or if you're me and it's not yet 11 o'clock in the morning, you can still severely screw up. So let's have a look at the recycle bin. Working. Right, so the first thing we want to do is we want to get the 80 optional feature. There is only one 80 optional feature in R2, the recycle bin feature. We have all the details that we need to pull from here. First thing we've got to do is we've got to make sure that we set the forest mode to being 2008 R2. The other thing about the recycle bin is if you are in a multiple domain environment, the recycle bin needs to be enabled for each domain. Don't think just by doing it in one place, even though it does make a schema change, it's going to enable it across the entire area. We say yes because it's a one-way thing. We then enable the feature. And we target the domain that we want the recycle bin to be in. It's done. That's enabled. So let's try this out. We get a call from the help desk that says, or the help desk says, we need to delete Bob. So we go looking for Bob, and we've got two Bobs. And we are told to delete Bob, blah, blah. We delete the wrong one. So what we can do is we can actually go and have a look for the AD object that has been deleted. And it puts this deleted object in a container called deleted objects. But we don't want to pull back the whole deleted objects container because that's also been given the isDeleted flag. So we filter that out. But because the deleted objects is normally filtered out, we need to include that in the scope. And there's our account, Bob Loblays. He's there to get it back. We just up arrow, and because PowerShell is using objects, we say, I want to grab that object, and I want to restore that object. Hit enter. And there's our Bob back. We've got two Bobs. What happens if, however, we delete everybody there? Up arrow, hit enter. Refresh. And they're all back again. Now, that was a heck of a lot less painful than doing an authoritative restore. Yes? Okay. Passwords. I hate the word passwords. I don't use the word password if I can at all help it. I tend to like using things like secret phrase or secret message or passphrase because that's what I use. It makes it easier to remember. It's nice and long. It's complicated. But unfortunately for the users, they don't seem to get it. We put into place a password complexity policy to say, you know, you've got to protect your identity. And the only way that you're going to do that is with a nice, strong password. And they'll go, how the heck could I remember something that's more than 8 letters long with a number in it? I know. I will write it on a post-it note and put it on my monitor. That's nice and secure. Of course, those who are security conscious, and we do have some in the organization, some users who are security conscious, they say, that's absolutely stupid, writing your password down and putting it on your monitor. Everyone knows to be secure, you put it under the keyboard. So what we needed to do for those who just could not manage complex passwords is we'd create a new domain. Or if we had a special need where we had accounts that had complicated passwords and needed them, we would create a separate domain for them. What we can do with 2008 R2 is to use password settings objects. Now, this isn't a group policy. It's actually just an AD setting, and it does apply to both groups and to user accounts. So we're going to go through and have a look at creating a password policy. We switch to advanced view. I just want to have a look. This is our AD. We've got created a group, a high security group. Just going to go to the attribute editor that we can see in the advanced view, and I'm going to pick up its distinguished name because we're going to use this later. So I'll copy that. And I'm going to open up ADSI Edit. Now, you can do the same things using PowerShell or LDP. But just to show you there are different ways of doing it, we're going to bind the domain. And I'm going to expand down until I find the system container. And inside the system container, we have the password settings objects container. At the moment, there are no password setting objects, so we create a new one. Whoops, sorry about that. Didn't know you could do demo failures with videos, did you? I do want to try and go through this a bit slowly because there are some of the settings here that we need to just make sure we can be aware of what's going on. So grabbing the distinguished name. and we're going to create a new password settings object. Okay, let's step through these things. First thing we want to do is give it a name. I'm sorry. It is, the demo gods are actually trying to circumvent my way of trying to get around them. Okay, I'll just talk through this as we go through. I'm not going to trust myself on this. All right, the first thing we need to do is to give it a name. Now, we can actually have multiple password setting objects, so the name is quite important here. And the second step that we will get to is to give it a precedence number. Now, the lowest number wins. We can have password settings objects, multiple password setting objects, applying to the same user. So the lowest precedence will win. We're going to say, do we want a reversible encryption? False. How many do we want to remember? 24 passwords. The minimum password age, how soon do we want them to not be able to change it? 1 day. Maximum password age, 2 days. A duration of the lockout period, 2 minutes. If it does get locked out, we'll lock it out for 100 days. We then need to add the distinguished name of the group or the user account that we want this to apply to. So we'll just paste that in. And you can have multiple entries in this password settings object. It's done. Now we've got Bob Loblaw in the group. So we'll actually have a look at the password settings objects that apply to Bob Loblaze, who doesn't have anything applying to him. We get a zero result. We do the same command for Bob Loblaw, and we see that we get the password settings applying to him. Now they're not actually going to work until the next time he changes his password and the password settings object has replicated to all of the domain controllers. If we want to, we could force them to log off and log on or force a replication. But the password policy itself, he won't be forced to put in a 24-character password with a minimum password age of 1 day and a maximum password age of 2 days until he gets to change his next password. Speaking of changing passwords, sysadmins manage service accounts. Service accounts are used for running services. 2008 R2 has introduced a concept called managed service accounts. Now, managed service accounts can be used for Exchange, they can be used for IIS, they can be used for a whole lot of services. They can't be used for SQL, unfortunately. But they do allow us to centrally manage accounts to run services in Active Directory without having an extra complexity layer on top of that. So let's have a look at these. I'm going to have a look at our services that are running on my Win7 client here. And I'm going to pick the SNMP trap, just for the sake of having one. It's currently running under the local service. First thing I need to do, I switch across to my domain controller and I say, I want to have a new AD managed service account. Now, to show you, there are currently none there. We're going to call this one SNMP trap. And I'm not going to give it a password. By not giving it a password, AD will generate a 240-character long random string as its password. I've got no idea what it's done for the password. There's our account in there. I then switch back to my client. Now, these managed service accounts can only be used by one machine at a time. So I'm using the PowerShell integrated scripting environment here. And I'm going to say, I want to install that managed service account that I created in AD onto this machine. Now, that managed service account can be used for any services on this machine and this machine only. I'll change the service to now run instead using the managed service account. And I don't put a password in. And the reason why I don't put a password in, because I've got no idea what the heck it is. The nice thing about this is that Windows itself, AD itself, will take care of changing the password. So even if somebody does go to the trouble of trying to crack it, by the time they do, it'll be changed. We change it to automatic. We start it up just to show that the service can actually run using the managed service account. And it started. Heck of a lot more security for your services that are running instead of just using local system or using another account where you have put in a password that you have to manage yourself. Yes. PowerShell. Yes. For every single machine, yes, because those accounts are stored on the in AD and then farmed out. It does mean, however, because they are individual accounts for each of the machines, you can run some auditing and other things across those to detect if those accounts are causing problems and therefore drill it down to which machine you're actually running on. So, sorry, the question was, if you've got several thousand clients and you're wanting to run antivirus on each one, can you use managed service accounts for running those AV programs? Yes, you can. Another tool that's been introduced with Server 2000 and R2 that you might not have seen is the Admin Center. Now, 2008 R2 Active Directory introduces a new interface called Web Services, ADWS. And we leverage that to create a new tool, the Admin Center. It's actually a browser leveraging the web services, and it is cross-domain and cross-forest. So we can use this to manage multiple forest environment. It is customizable, and we will have a look at how we can customize the interface for managing users. So just start typing Admin Center. I never go to the control panel or anything these days using Windows 7 or 2008 R2. The search box is fantastic. We start up the Admin Center and we get a web interface. It's not using the browser, but it is using a web interface to do it. Search for Bob. There's Bob Loblaw's account. We can access all of the areas of his account, including the extensions and other attributes that exist in AD. It's the attribute editor. Also, all of that's available. And if we want to give somebody access to managing these accounts, but we don't want to give them the ability to get to some of these extra attributes of the account, we can turn off components. And we can say, you know, they can't get to the extensions, they can't get to the profile information, they can only get to other areas. From here as well, in managing the account, we can change passwords. We've got a list of tasks on the right-hand side that we can leverage. So we want to reset Bob's password because he's forgotten it. So we type in password. However, if you remember, Bob was put into the high security group. So we get an error message. And it actually tells us why we can't change his password to password. It needs to be 24 characters long. So the solution, password, password, password. That works. Password being reset. He's now subject to the high security password policy. You will find on the left-hand side all of the recent places that you have visited, the OUs, domains, and other areas, and they can provide a useful shortcut for those areas that you are regularly managing. We have fold-out, fly-out tabs for accessing those other areas in AD. So if you haven't had a look at the admin center and you've been spending all of your time using Active Directory users and computers for managing users, have a look. You might find that, particularly for some environments that are web services heavy, that it's a useful alternative to use. Windows 7 deployment. You have a machine at a remote location that's not connected to the domain. We need to connect it to the domain. Another thing that 2008 R2 brings to the table is offline domain joins. To do an offline domain join, we create the computer account in the domain. You should always pre-stage accounts in the domain. We say that we want to do an offline domain join of this account. And on the machine that we're running this, it will generate a text file. We take that text file to the Windows 7 client. It has to be Windows 7 or greater. We then say, I want to do a dejoin, offline domain join of that computer to the domain, point it to the text file, and it will pull all the credentials, the shared secret that it uses to generate the Kerberos ticket, onto the machine. The next time that machine starts up connected to a network that can access the domain controllers, it's already there, it can already authenticate. So particularly in an environment where you've got remote machines, this could be really useful. We now flip over to the stuff that's not, strictly speaking, 2008 R2. So for those of you who are still operating in the dark ages, 2003 and earlier, you can leverage some of this stuff in your environment. How many people have heard of shadow groups? Not many. Only 5-10%. Okay, shadow groups are groups that you don't actually manage yourself. Shadow groups are used to manage your environment by doing queries themselves to populate themselves. Might be easier if we show you what's actually going on here. So, play. So I'm going to actually go back to Active Directory users and computers, and I've got a group here that I've called Location Sydney. Now, Location Sydney currently has no members. I'm going to have a look at my OUs, which I've got based on location, and here are some Sydney people, and I'm going to put this person into Sydney just by changing their office location. I go back and have a look at the Location Sydney group, and we now find that under the members, that person's now a member. I didn't have to add them. We'll go back and take them out. Bless you. This is the description fields, remember. Often people have the ability to change their own descriptions. They're now no longer in that group. Let's put everybody who's in Sydney in Sydney. Change the office location for them. And And then I'll go back and have a look at the membership of the group. And we'll now see that everybody is actually in the Sydney group. Now, there is a little bit of smoke and mirrors going on here. There is a scheduled task running in the background that's running a script. What that script is doing, we'll just get to the script. So there's the name of the script is shadowgroup.vbs. You can get a copy of this script off Dan Holmes' site. If you go to the link at the end of the slide deck, go to the blog section and search for Administrator Idol. All I've done is changed it to include location Sydney, the name of the domain, the OU that it's looking at, and the LDAP query string that we need in order to populate the group. Now, you might think my LDAP query writing abilities aren't really that fantastic. Is there an easy way to generate an LDAP query string? And there is. You already have that available in Active Directory users and computers. You just go up to... Just get rid of that box. We just go up to saved queries and we generate a saved query. Now, the saved query that I'm going to use now, we can use this to see, all right, who hasn't got an office location set? So who has escaped the net, if you like, of this script running to put people into the right areas? So we're going to do a custom search. We're going to search on the user object. We're going to pick up the office location and we're going to say, if it's not present, that's who we want to pick up. There is our LDAP string. We can then paste that into the script. We've run the query. We've now got all the people that don't have an office location set. So I can go to the other OUs and can say, well, in order to manage these people, we want to have them in the right groups. So we'll just go through and set their office location. Once we've set all the office locations for all of the users, we can then go back to our saved query, rerun it again, and we should get no results. Or we'll just get the built-in accounts and me. All good. Everyone who should have a location now has a location, which means that the shadow groups running those scripts should be able to manage things. So let's extend that a little bit. We're going to play around with groups and leveraging the ability of these groups to do things. How many of you have used restricted groups? Restricted groups have been around, only a handful of people. Restricted groups have actually been around since Windows 2000. Initially, though, with restricted groups, we only had the top section. The top section here, members of this group, is exclusive. You put people in here and it keeps them in that group. You can't add other people to the group. You can't remove people from the group except by using the restricted group policy setting. Since 2003, we now have the ability to have this group being a member of other things. So, cumulative setting. We're going to talk about using the second part. So, we use shadow groups, or we use some other method of putting people into a group. And then we have that group, like location Sydney, being a member of something else. It could well be you've got a situation with people needing local admin access on their machines, for example. We might create a group to say poor user or annoying user or something like that, that the help desk has the ability to manage. We then go into restricted groups and we put the annoying users group into... We make that group a member of the local administrators. Now, there's nobody normally in this group because users really aren't that annoying. And it's okay. You must be like me and haven't quite woken up yet. When somebody gets put into that annoying users group, the policy will say, that's cool. We're not restricting the membership. We're not being exclusive. But now because they are a member of that group, by virtue of the restricted group's policy, they're also now a member of admins. When they get taken out of that group, they're now no longer a member of the admins. But by using restricted groups, we're stopping people being able to use other tools to give themselves admin rights. We've got some little tips here about how to implement that. This is where we really talk about using groups to define roles of users and then managing which groups should be members of other groups and do it in a cumulative fashion. The other thing about groups and being able to put people into groups, did you know that you can manage group memberships without having to use Active Directory users and computers or the command line? One of the reasons why we often don't delegate administration to other people, to the non-techies for their group memberships, is because we think, oh, I have to install a task pad or I have to install Active Directory users and computers on their system, and that gives them too much power. If you have nominated somebody as being responsible for managing a group in AD, we just put their name in the management box there and we can tick the box to say they are able to manage the membership of this group. In order for them to manage the membership of the group, all they need to do is to go to search, network, Active Directory, do an Active Directory search for their group. Just using the normal search tools. When the group pops up, there will be a button that they can click that allows them to add and remove members. And if they are the person that's nominated as the person with the ability to manage the group, they can change group membership. This way we avoid the round-robin situation where somebody rings up their help desk and says, I'm in finance, I need access to the finance documents. Help desk goes, we can't give you access to those without your manager's approval, so they have to ring up the manager. The manager says, yes, that person's allowed to have access. So we then go and give them access to that group and call them back and say, you've now got access to the resources. So much simpler, that person would just go to the manager and say, can you add me to the group? We actually reduce a lot of these sort of silly calls to the help desk. Some other tips. Computers. Many of you probably know that users by default can add up to 10 machines to a domain. I don't know about you, but as a system administrator, I get a little bit antsy about people adding machines to a domain that I am responsible for without me knowing about it. Remove that right. Delegate permissions to joining machines to domains if you need to do so. And you can use the redircmp command in order to redirect the creation of computer accounts or adding computers to a domain if you haven't already pre-staged them. Now, when you create a new computer account, when a computer adds the domain, where does it go? The computer's container. The computer's container is not an OU, which means we cannot apply group policy to that container. It's open, unfettered access. Why not create an organizational unit in your domain structure? Lock it down. Make sure that any computer accounts that are in that organizational unit can't do anything. And then use the redirection command to redirect any new computer accounts. Any computer accounts that are connecting to the domain, they get dumped into that OU. What you would then do is for any computer accounts that you do want to have created in the domain is you would pre-stage them in the appropriate organizational units. They will then pick up all the rights that are associated with those OUs, all the policies that are associated with them, and you don't have issues of machines that are getting access to things that they shouldn't be getting access to. Most of us have probably experienced the situation where the machine has lost its secure connection as well. The typical approach, I'll just remove it from the domain and rejoin it to the domain. When you remove a computer account from the domain and re-add it to the domain, what does it do? It changes its security identifier, which is going to change any access control lists or other things that you might have set for the computer account. First step you want to do if it loses its secure channel, reset the computer account. And what it will do is it will make it as if it is a brand new pre-staged account, but with the same SID that it previously had. Then you can try and reconnect. And if it doesn't reconnect then, offline domain join it and remove it offline and then re-add it in again. And it will pick up the old account. It'll reset its own secure channel connection and you should all be good again. And if you are passing computer accounts from one place, computers from one person to another, and you want to make sure that the security settings are the same, just rename the computer account. We'll talk a bit more about computer SIDs and computer security on the identifiers in my afternoon session if you wanted to hear more about that. User accounts. How many people have user accounts, last name, comma, first name? Okay, about 10% of the room again. Please change that. You've probably got last name, comma, first name so that you can sort by last name or find people on last name. Just add a last name field. Put them in first name, last name. Because if you have last name, comma, first name, it stores its distinguished name inside Active Directory with an escaped comma. It's part of the name. AD uses commas to separate attributes. It doesn't want to pick up that comma in the name to separate the attributes, so it will put a backslash in front of it. Normally that's not going to be a problem, but if you're going to be using scripts to manage your user accounts, the backslash can sometimes cause those scripts to throw an exception or to escape the wrong character. And I'm a big believer in not trying to introduce little things into my environment that are going to cause me errors down the track that are going to be hell to troubleshoot. If you do want to search on last name, pop in a last name field. Just add an extra column into Active Directory users and computers, and you can sort by that if you want. But you say, I've already tried that and there is a problem. The problem is, if I add a last name column to Active Directory users and computers, when I look at my computer accounts, there is a last name column there. Computers don't have last names. This is inefficient. This is distracting and it's annoying. Tough. In fact, there is an absolute benefit for doing this. Did you know that all computer accounts do have a last name field? It's just not used. Why don't we use it? Remember those shadow groups that we talked about before? We can run policies that are configured to run filtered on those shadow groups. We could have things that will do LDAP writes to different fields. Why don't we use the last name field for the computer accounts to store something useful, like, I don't know, its IP address, or the currently logged on user, or its BIOS level, or its location, or which we can use in the location field anyway. We can do a whole lot, put a whole lot of information into these unused fields, these LDAP fields in the computer account that enable us to manage our environment more effectively, giving us access to information that we don't have to go and dig for. It's already there exposed for us. And because that information is available in an LDAP field, which we can query, We can then further leverage those shadow groups to do other things. Put the BIOS details in there, a BIOS update comes out. We then apply the BIOS update to every computer that is in that particular group. Because we are generating the information in the field, once the BIOS has been updated, it'll rerun the query. It notes that the BIOS information has changed. It can then pull that computer out of the shadow group, which means it's not constantly trying to update its BIOS. What about model number? If you can query it doing a WMI call, bang it in there. If you want to use it, leverage it. Don't let the name of the column restrict what you can be inventive about. If you can do a WMI call or query the information, pull the information out, you can write it into those fields.
What about special characters in those things?
If you're running scripts, I try and avoid them unless you can...
No, the reason I ask is some model and some WMI calls come up with hashes and things in the thing. That might actually use issues.
Okay, if you might want to test that first. So the question was, what about special characters that might cause issues in the model numbers and that? Test it first, but because the only things that might be looking at those fields are the ones that are knowing about those special characters, we should be able to manage that situation as well. But good question. So we can actually use this and leverage this ability to do some self-reporting of the machines. Rather than us continually running queries, continually digging for information and running PowerShell queries against things, WMI calls, we've already got the access to the information there by virtue of having a look at the membership of a group. I've mentioned about self-staging change control with BIOS updates, hot fixes or other things, information that we can query and manage using group policy. The last thing we really want to talk about today is task pads. Anybody actually using task pads? That's what I thought. There's probably less than a dozen in the room. Task pads are one of those things that we think, well, we would use task pads to give somebody who's not an administrator the ability to do an administrator type thing like resetting passwords or doing something else like that. What I want to show you is a way to leverage task pad views inside Microsoft Management Consoles in order to shortcut some of the admin processes that we are involved in. So this is the last demo. I'm going to open up a fresh Microsoft Management Console. And I'm going to add some components. Now, normally when you add components, you think, I can just add them to the console root. You can actually create a hierarchy of things by adding folders. So I'm going to add a folder to my console root. And now I have the ability to add extra snap-ins under that folder. So I'm going to add in the group policy management snap-in and the remote desktop snap-in. You're probably familiar with building your own custom consoles. I'm going to rename that to Remote Management, Remote Machine Tools. And I get a hierarchical structure for my console, which is a little bit easy to manage. But look, I want to be able to have access to the tools that I want to use inside my Microsoft Management Console. So I go to a task pad view, and I have a number of choices in the way that I look at this, but I'm going to go for a vertical view, and I'm going to add a shell command. Now, the shell command I'm going to use here is psexec. If you don't know about the Sys internals PS tools and you're a sysadmin, you're doing yourself a major disfavor. I'm going to do psexec here. I'm going to pull the machine name from the column 0, and I'm going to run command.exe. And for those of you who have used this before, you will know that running psexec machine named CMD will open up a command prompt on the remote machine. I'll pick an icon.
That'll do.
Now when I click on the machine, I get the shell command there, and I can just click on it, and by doing a host name, you can see that while I'm running my DC, my command prompt is actually on. Should I just make that a bit bigger so we can see? My command prompt's running on my Win 7 client. I'm not restricted to just having one shell command there either. I can add some others. For example, I've got a remote command line there. I might want to have a remote desktop. So MSTSC. I need the machine name. So once again, I'll pull that machine name from the column. Select name. Give it a name, remote desktop, so I can actually see what it is I'm clicking on. Give it an icon. And now when I click on the machine name, you see I've got the ability to go straight into a remote desktop prompt. Type in my credentials and remote desktop connection. You have the ability to customize the tools that you use using task pads to give you that extra functionality inside the Microsoft Management Console rather than having to jump from tool to tool to tool. And that's just what we talked about. These are the resources that I drew on for this talk. They have come from multiple sources, and the intellium.com/resource-kit is Dan Holm's site on the right-hand side there. If you go there, you won't see Administrator Idle sitting right up there to begin with. But if you go into the blog section and search for Administrator's Idle, you'll see all the scripts that we use for generating those shadow group queries. We have, according to my time here, 10 minutes before the session is supposed to finish. So what we can do now is we can allow for Q&A, but for those who want to go early and have an early mark and maybe do some TechQuest tag scanning, thank you for coming along. Please fill in an evaluation. I think ones are bad, fives are good. And please put comments in. It's the comments that you provide in the evaluations that help us make TechEd better. Thank you, and we'll answer questions. Yes? Yes. The recycle bin, can we use it for group policy objects? It's for objects inside AD. Group policy objects aren't strictly objects. So computer accounts, group accounts, organisational units, user accounts, all those things will go into the recycle bin. Good question. If you want to manage group policies and affect them that way, use the Advanced Group Policy Management Console, which allows you to roll back changes that you've made and recover old group policies. Is there any other questions? So, yes.
We've tried to do some scripting on people logging on the computers.
Yes.
And they normally just by foot their username.
Yes.
And then the domain's in there. But we get some people that precede their name with the domain, and that throws out the scripting. Is there some way of preventing users from putting the domain / username?
So if we are doing some auditing to get people's usernames when they're logging on,
yes,
and they're putting in the domain name, which is throwing out the scripts and that sort of thing, whenever we rely on users to enter information, we're going to run into problems. So this is where we could leverage things like the shadow groups to have the computer account populate when users are logged on to it, and then by virtue of that, do an LDAP query on the computer account for whatever is stored inside the last name field, for example. Extract that information. Because we're using the computer to generate the username, we're going to get a consistent interface that way. But when you could do a who am I, or you could do other things, scripts that are running for group policy, startup scripts, sorry, logon scripts, for example, as well. But whenever we are relying on users to do that, unless we are able to parse the information, like putting in an info path box or something else to parse the information, you're going to have people screwing things up. Yes. SharePoint runs on ISO, yes. But, okay. Can we use managed service accounts for SharePoint? There are some issues, I believe, with SharePoint doing some account management of its accounts. So for the initial setup and things like that, probably best to talk to the SharePoint people, because they do some funky things that are on top of AD. But, yeah, and there are some sessions from the US that... Joel Olson and Shane Young, I think, have done on how to manage the accounts that are used for setting up SharePoint, at least, and the minimum number of accounts you should use and which ones you shouldn't be using for that. So do a search for those SharePoint talks on deployment, SharePoint deployment installation best practice, and that should answer some of those questions. But yeah, the managed service accounts for that, yeah, there are a few little disconnects there. So thanks. Sorry? Dan Holmes, yeah, he was... I'm not sure whether he actually managed to make it here this morning, but he's... he's at the AvPoint, most of the time at the AvPoint stand in the expo.
Thanks. Can you export those task pads out and distribute
them around? Yeah, there's just Microsoft Management Console, so you just save the console file and export the console file. Absolutely. Sorry, the question just for the recording was, can you export those console, the task pads, to distribute to other people? Yes, they're just console files. Absolutely.
And sorry, one more question. Is there any impact or do you need to be concerned about Active Directory load when you do things like if you went to town and started under that computer's view using those other attributes, things like IP address and last...
Do we need to be concerned about an impact on performance for AD for populating those other fields? Yes, it's obviously if you're running scripts on things, it is going to add extra load. However, this is all part of the management of your design of your system. Hopefully, by running these scripts, you're able to spread out some of these tasks and loads on things, so that you don't end up with we need to run a big batch of things on all these people in one hit. It's a management technique. So we're translating human work, I suppose, into computer work, so scope that appropriately.
And it's okay with RADCs? That all works in an RADC environment? A lot of RADCs out there people look onto?
Yep, does it work with RADCs? However, RADCs will always pass the authentication request through to a writable domain controller if they can make a connection to a writable domain controller. It's only when they can't connect to a writable domain controller that RODCs are actually going to then use the cache credentials to do the authentication for them. Thanks. Yes? Sorry, how does the AD recycle bin, it has by default, and it is configurable, a retention period of 180 days. And then after that, you go into the tombstone interval, which once again, by default, is 180 days. What it will do is it will set a flag, the is deleted flag, first, which is normally would normally be used for the tombstone stuff, and then it replaces that with an is recycled. So if you have a look at the timeline, the object is deleted. It has the is deleted flag, which means it is recoverable from the AD recycle bin. After 180 days, it falls out of the AD recycle bin. It is tombstoned. The is deleted flag goes away, it becomes is recyclable. That means it can be recovered using authoritative restores. After another 180 days, the object is scavenged and gone and therefore no longer available to be pulled back. Does that answer the question? Cool, thank you. I'm going to let Rick take over the stage. If you've got other questions, please feel free to come down and ask me about them.